Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, Emily McCord and Politics Ohio. Our weekly series road trip takes us to the streets of Cleveland. Poet Noah Falk pays a visit to Conrad's Corner, and we'll talk manufacturing and jobs with Steve Staub with Staub Manufacturing Solutions. That's all coming up. First, American Style Magazine has released their annual list of top 25 mid-sized cities for art, and for the first time this year, Dayton, Ohio made the list. An extensive write-in campaign put the Gem City into the number two spot. Martine Meredith Collier is president of CultureWorks. She helped get the campaign off the ground. I spoke to her just before she boarded a plane bound for San Antonio and the Americans for the Arts Conference.
I came to Dayton last May to begin this position, and I was familiar with American Style magazine, and when the summer issue came out, I always check it to see what cities are there. I just sort of assumed Dayton would be there because I'm so impressed by the arts and culture that it's here at all different levels. So I was surprised last year that we weren't listed. I've checked under small cities, checked under mid-sized cities. So I sent a big packet of information to American Style magazine and talked to the Convention and Visitors Bureau about working together to fix this. And, I sent a letter and information about the arts organizations and said, you know, you really need to put Dayton on the ballot for next year. And so when February is when the balloting comes out, it's an online process. So I waited for the ballot to come out. I went to their website and we weren't there. So there was a place, a little box for other, so you could write it in. So what we did is CultureWorks put the link to the magazine on our website, and we got the word out. We worked with the Convention and Visitors Bureau. The Chamber helped us get the word out. The Downtown Partnership helped us get the word out. And it went a little viral on everyone's Facebook pages. So everybody that got the message to vote was asked to send send that message out to all of their friends and contacts. And it obviously worked. I truly wanted us on the list, but the fact that we came in as number two means that people really, really, it was a huge outpouring of civic pride for that many people to log on. And now, I don't know if you're aware of this, but the magazine, the issue that the summer issue where we're listed as number two for mid-sized communities, there, the editor's page, page 11, actually talks about the fact Dayton has never been listed before and about the grassroots effort that brought that about, and even refers to a visionary leadership and a very committed and arts community. So that's good for Dayton. But the editor's page was as good as the listing because it really showed not only how great we are, but also how our citizens got behind the effort to make sure American Style magazine knew how great we are.
Well, that is great, and it's probably maybe more unlikely that we'll be left off the list in the future.
Well, I think what's happened, first of all, next year I think we go for number one. We try and redouble our efforts, but you know, we have shown other communities that they can do this, that you cannot be on the ballot and you can write in. So we're probably going to have a lot more competition next year. But I am just so pleased that people really, that this resonated with citizens. And, you know, people were just outraged that we weren't included because people are very, very proud of the cultural vitality of this community. And I thought it was great that everyone, you know, that enough people went online and voted to make this happen. One thing I have noticed, and maybe it's a Midwestern thing, but I love Dayton, love living here. It's just fabulous. But sometimes Dayton is reluctant to toot its own horn a little bit about aw shucks, we're just Dayton kind of thing. The arts and culture that's here is really, really world class. I mean, it's fabulous. I was so proud of the citizens who voted because they really recognized that and wanted to send that word out to a national constituency. So I think it's great.
Martine, I don't want to take any more of your time, but I really appreciate you doing this. Have a safe trip, and when you get back, contact us. Let's sit down here in the studio and do a little more formal interview about what's going on.
I'm on my way to the Americans for the Arts Conference in San Antonio. Americans for the Arts actually contacted me in March asking for us to participate in a session on new business models in the arts at the conference because they had read about the merger in Dayton of the Philharmonic, the Ballet, and the Opera, which is the first of its kind in the United States. So I hope to have a lot of opportunities at this conference to talk up Dayton and the Dayton region, and I have a copy of American Style magazine in my briefcase.
Well, that's wonderful. Let's talk about your experience and the trip to the conference when you get back.
That would be great.
Martine, thanks so much. Have a safe trip.
Okay. Thank you, Jerry. Appreciate it.
This is WISO Weekend on WYSO. In our weekly series Road Trip, radio producers from around the state take you on audio tours from the New Ohio Guide. Today, we take to the streets of Cleveland to explore the city's vibrant Asiatown district with producer Karen Schaefer. It's part of a tour of Cleveland's ethnic neighborhoods along U.S. Route 20.
As musicians strike up traditional Chinese cymbals, gongs, and drums, the crowd at Cleveland's Asia Plaza parts to reveal a gold-spangled, white-furred Chinese lion. The lion whips and gyrates to the music as it circles the audience. Its red-tongued mouth plucks red and gold cash-filled envelopes from the hands of giggling children. This is the traditional lion dance of the Chinese Lunar New Year, meant to bring good luck. George Kwan, a Cleveland policeman, is head of the dance troupe. He says it was his father, a native of mainland China, who started in dancing.
Well, this is my father's tradition. When he was alive, he trained us. He got us more training than we ever wanted, and we're continuing on that tradition. Now we're working on the third generation.
Today, Cleveland's Asiatown is a vibrant 15-block district of restaurants, groceries, and small shops, marked by distinctive red banners, pagoda-style storefronts, and Chinese zodiac street sculptures. But in the 1870s, when the first Chinese immigrants arrived from the gold fields of California, their laundries and garment shops occupied just a few blocks on Ontario Street. John Grabowski, an historian at the Western Reserve Historical Society, says an incident in 1925 nearly destroyed the community. That's when murders between rival Chinese gangs, or tongs, led to a police raid on Cleveland's Chinatown.
They simply went out and arrested everybody who was Chinese or picked them up. And that had repercussions. Repercussions were in diplomatic relations with China, went right to Washington.
City officials eventually apologized, but not before they tore down the original Chinese settlement. Later Asian immigrants suffered similar indignities. During World War II, Cleveland's Japanese Americans, along with tens of thousands of others nationwide, were rounded up and held in West Coast internment camps.
I feel that there is a lot of misunderstanding between cultural differences.
Cleveland filmmaker Johnny Wu is president of the local chapter of the Organization of Chinese Americans. He says a few years ago, he began thinking about ways to bridge what he saw as the cultural divide between Cleveland's Asian and non-Asian populations.
And there were a lot of people felt like the Asian culture is very taboo for them or very secrecy. And the Asian community also very much close-knit together. It doesn't want to trust anybody else outside their own community. So it built this kind of barrier between the Western and Eastern culture.
5 years ago, Wu and other Asian Americans from Japan, Korea, the Philippines, and Vietnam organized the first day-long Lunar New Year celebration. It now attracts hundreds of visitors. And tens of thousands of people flock to the annual two-day Asian festival in May. And as the region's Asian population continues to grow, about 33,000 in the last census, the city of Cleveland is working on a 10-year plan to make Asiatown an even more vibrant neighborhood. In Cleveland, I'm Karen Schaefer.
You can download the New Ohio Guide tours at COhioFirst.org. The New Ohio Guide is produced by the Ohio Humanities Council, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Noah Falk has been published in online journals, print anthologies, and in his own chapbooks. His new book, Snowman Losing Weight, is Falk's first hardbound collection of poems. Recently, he sat down with our own Conrad Balliet to discuss poetry.
I have a guest today. His name is Noah Falk. Hi, Noah.
Hello, Conrad. How are you doing?
Okay. And where are you from?
I'm originally from Dayton, the Oakwood suburb of Dayton. So I'm right around the Dayton area, yeah.
Originally.
Originally.
I mean, born and reared here.
I am born and raised.
Native Ohio boy.
I am a Daytonian. Through the heart. You got it.
Okay. And you're also a poet.
I would consider myself, yeah. I like to play with words.
And you don't mind saying you are a poet?
Actually, no, I don't. It took me a while to actually feel like that I was a poet. So it was strange. It took some time. I was a jock in high school, so that kind of didn't necessarily play well to the poetry world inside me, but it bloomed eventually.
And what does the word poet mean? How would you define poet?
I think a poet is someone who has a great sensibility of language and appreciates it for what it can do to the inner part of you.
What would you like your poetry to do? Do you have any aims for it?
Sure. I think the poems that have inspired me are the poems that kind of outgrow the poet themselves and become their own. The poem itself is kind of its own entity. So I always want my poems to kind of outgrow me as a poet. I want people to think of just a great poem. Wow, that was a great poem. Good poems can do that. You don't really necessarily need to think of, oh, that's a Donald Justice poem or a Wallace Stevens poem. It's just a great poem.
Who are the poets who have influenced you?
I just named two of them. I'm infatuated with Donald Justice. I have been for several years. I'm also into Wallace Stevens. I'm into Peter Gizzi, William Carlos Williams, I consider kind of a godfather. Uh-huh. Charles Simic, James Tate, Kenneth Koch. I'm really into contemporary poetry. I like Zachary Schramberg. I like Matthias Svalina. And there's a lot of great, great poets in Cincinnati. One of my favorite poets is Matt Hart. He's actually going to be reading with me Sunday evening.
Huh.
And there's some other, terrific poets like Nick Stern out of Akron. Matt McBride is also out of Cincinnati. So there's a lot of just brimming worlds of poetry around here in the Ohio area, which is kind of exciting to think about.
And do you publish your poetry?
I do publish my poetry. I send it out to, at times. I mean, there was a moment where I was hesitant to send my work anywhere because I never thought it was worthy of someone else's eyes. But I've got beyond that and started, editing vigorously and finding this could possibly show up in a journal somewhere. So, yeah.
And you've been successful.
I would like to think I have.
Where have some appeared?
I've had some in the Kenyon Review. I've had some forthcoming in the Boston Review. I've had some in a great journal down in Cincinnati called Forklift Ohio. And a lot of the online contemporary journals, Hangman. There's a journal called Sentence, a journal of prose poetics.
Sounds very good. Well, we've been talking about it. I'd like to hear some.
Sure. This one's called The Edges of a Simple Scene. And then there came a guilty man with a tribal tattoo and a car running out of breath in the alley. And his cell phone rang as he tugged up his pants and the static of a baby crying blue from the back seat. In a car running out of breath, and he stormed into the house like brush fire, like a wild animal trapped in a sunset, and curse words were more than mechanical. And onto the back porch came the guilty man, grasping a woman by the weight of her hair, and their lips whipped loud distances, and the static of the baby swelled with corruption. And a pack of neighborhood dogs sang electric as the woman kicked the guilty man in the groin, and to the ground he fell. And four trigger clicks later, there was silence.
That was one of your best readings.
Oh, thank you.
Very good, Noah. Very
Thanks
good.
A lot.
And where did this poem come from? Is there any event behind it, or is it just sheer imagination?
Sure. There is. It's kind of a combination of both. I lived in a part of Dayton called Walnut Hills over on Illinois Avenue, and I lived next to this vacant house for a while, and there was people in it who shouldn't have been in it. It was supposed to be a vacant house, and there was a lot of strange happenings. And one day I was sitting there and listening to whatever was going on in that house, and I was thinking, this is kind of bizarre. What is happening over there? So I started getting these images in my head. So it's kind of a combination of things that could happen and the imagination. So
and some things that did happen?
There wasn't any click triggers, but there were some violent noises, and,
Well, that was good. Let's try Thanks. Another one.
Sure. Let's go ahead and try one called Hawthorne Hill. This one's actually based off of the Wright brothers' home, which is in Oakwood. And I used to, when I was growing up, we used to go sledding over there, which is no longer permitted, but a nice hill over there. On snowy afternoons, children bleed through noses, but are happy as long as the flakes continue. The flakes continue. They interrupt each other like on-off switches. There's a father in a station wagon at the bottom of the hill, snoring. The steepest part of the hill makes walking inventive. The snow melts on the soles of puffy moon boots, on chubby cherry red cheeks. "I'll race you to the street," a tiny boy yells. A dog's ears flutter at the meshing of high-pitched voices. Snowballs fall 15 feet short. More children arrive, layered like coffee cake, and behind a window in a house across the street, someone's grandmother stares out at the merging plastic sleds. She grins as she remembers her first bloody nose, and afterwards clumping home through the snow with a sticky, red-toothed smile.
Now, this poem, as I look at it on the page, it looks like a paragraph.
Yes.
How do you decide whether to make something look like a poem or look like a paragraph?
That's a really good question. This could actually be broken down into stanzas or broken into lines, but for some reason I went on a streak of about a year of just trying to crank out prose poems or paragraph poems, block poems, and it takes away from the worry of where do I break it, where do I cut it, you know?
Okay. And you said crank out. Does that mean this just sort of you have a little crank inside
yeah,
and
right,
you
exactly.
turn it and these come out?
That's exactly what it is.
Do you spend any time revising or is it just the way it comes out?
Oh, no. I spend quite a bit of time revising. I think that I'm definitely not of the Allen Ginsberg school of best thought. I'm more of a, look at it, put it in a drawer, come back to it a week later, look at it again, take out, add in, it's kind of a constant. I don't think I've ever written a poem in one sitting and felt comfortable with it. So.
Well, that sounds like a real poet.
Yeah.
Okay, Noah, one more?
Yeah, let's do one more. This one is actually called The Measuring Tape for the Midwest, and this is the title poem for my second chapbook, and it's also in my new book, Snowman Losing Weight. Put out by Bat Cat Press, which is actually an all-student-run press in Midland, Pennsylvania. Okay, let's do The Measuring Tape for the Midwest. The measuring tape for the Midwest extends beyond the five flavors of boredom and further than the dimple-smeared children circling the food court could ever imagine. It cuts through the town where the pop-top was invented, the town of the backpack vacuum cleaner, the first electric street light, and along the traffic aisle, where the three-legged stray dog everyone feeds but refuses to pet shivers before stumbling out into the distance, where several new roads emerge beneath a caution light blinking above teenagers who suck face and viciously exchange bubblegum and mononucleosis as shadows of fertilized corn husks sway like children on roller skates. It stretches into these remote zip codes you've always wondered about, where your dreams take place, where a single tree silhouetting the horizon is not quite ready for rain, where every August there is a sunset that bleeds into September. It bumps down dirt roads and amplifies the people from one-light towns and people hugging in small groups, their colorful fanny packs overlapping in smoke-groomed bowling alleys where everything swallows like cigarette ash, and sunburn appears unexpectedly like a sixth child and unfolds near funny red-lipped people drinking to get drunk because not everything needs an answer, because breathing only stops after another double bacon cheeseburger and continues down alleyways and crosswalks through toll booths and potholes near chain-link fenced-in yards which hold children and plastic and innocence with storms on the horizon and horizons on the storm. The sounds like unhung paintings left in the closet, like snow-filled landscapes and whispers and far-out lawns where people are being born and people are dying and people are laughing out loud and scaring hiccups out of their bodies beneath sudden gushes of acid rain.
Wow. That was very different and very vivid.
Thanks.
I think, Noah, you have a good variety of good-sounding poems.
Thanks a lot, Conrad. I appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks for being here.
I appreciate it. It was very fun. Anytime.
Noah Falk.
The release party for Falk's book, Snowman Losing Weight, takes place tonight at Canal Street Tavern in Dayton. Also appearing, poets Matt Hart and Nick Sturm, and music from King Elk, the Judy Blooms, Henry Daggs, and Speaking Sons. This is WISO Weekend. A recent survey conducted by MadeInDaytonBlog.com indicates that many manufacturing jobs in the Dayton area remain unfilled, despite large numbers of people looking for work. I spoke with Steve Staub, co-founder of the Made in Dayton blog and CEO with Staub Manufacturing Solutions, to find out why the disconnect.
A lot of people have assumed the manufacturing industry is dead. When GM left town and some of the companies like that, they say, oh, there's nothing here anymore, when in reality, we make more in this country today than we ever have. Now, we're doing it with less people, and our people are much more skilled than they used to be. We no longer need a guy with no skills hanging a door on a hook as it goes down the assembly line. We need somebody with good common sense and good math skills that is a problem solver. So we got looking at, gee, how do we figure out how many's out there? And we conducted the survey. We posted it out on the blog, posted it on LinkedIn and a few other things, and we had 101 responses, which we were just tickled to death of that for the first time we've ever done it, and came out that, you know, depending how you interpret the numbers, that there could be close to 7,000 jobs available in our region.
And so you heard from a fraction of manufacturers here in Dayton, so you're thinking the results lead to bigger numbers?
Exactly, yeah. The 101 people replied, and I think, I don't have it in front of me, I think it was 697 available jobs that those 101 respondents came back with. Everybody came back and had at least two or three positions open, and a couple of people have asked me, well, why aren't we seeing pages and pages and pages of advertisements for these jobs in the news? So a lot of people have gone to other methods like Craigslist, whereas just this week there's over 70 different jobs in manufacturing on Craigslist. You're not seeing it in the traditional ways to advertise. You're seeing them listed in these free publications. And a lot of people have commented when they filled out that they just quit advertising, that they spend a lot of money on Monster, a lot in the newspapers, and just quit and trying to get by with what they've got, but they still have these open positions. They're waiting for people to show up.
Could you just tell me a little bit about the Made in Dayton blog? When and how did that start?
We started that back December 1st, myself and a gentleman named Gary Weldon, just because we saw a need for this kind of an open forum for the industry to be out there. A lot of organizations in the Dayton region that have their fingers in manufacturing, but no real one online source to disseminate all the information from all these other groups. How great could that be? As a business owner, someone could go there and find anything they need on the industry and events that are happening. Sinclair puts events on there, UD does, and just really works out well.
With regard to the survey, companies are telling you that they need people, and they will train people that don't quite have the skills that they're looking for.
Exactly. A lot of companies, Dayton Progress, they're a manufacturing company south of town, and then there's a place in Springfield called Morgul Machine that both have actually started working with their local high schools to get kids coming out of the high school or even between their junior and senior years working there in the summer times to learn more about the industry.
Yeah, I actually spoke to Dayton Progress at the time they initiated their challenge.
Great.
And so they just wrapped that up. How important do you feel efforts like that to reach younger people entering the workforce is?
I think it's fantastic. If all manufacturing companies in our region did it, we wouldn't probably have this issue. But most don't. You know, most don't have the resources and the vision, you know, like Dayton Progress and others. You know, many do, but a lot don't.
One final question for you, Steve. And any solutions suggested from your respondents to your survey on how to better match up people looking for work with these empty jobs?
Well, there's a couple of things we're working on out of that. We're working with the Dayton Region Manufacturers Association. They've got some neat initiatives. Actually, we're part of a group now that has started meeting of about 10 companies to really try to figure out how to solve this. There's some people from the education world. There's private people just to really look at, we've got this mismatch. We've got all these people. How do we solve this problem? So it is something that's definitely being addressed, and this is really one of the first steps that we wanted to show exactly how many positions are out there so that we can, you know, look forward and hopefully get some support from the public sector, and showing, yeah, this is a viable option to help with the whole unemployment issues.
Well, Steve, I'd love to talk to you further as you guys come up with solutions to that.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Steve.
Take care.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Emily McCord. Last week, a judge threw out a lawsuit challenging slots like machines in Ohio, and we spoke to the group Ohio Roundtable, who says it's considering an appeal on the grounds that it violates the Constitution. Today, I'm speaking with Bob Tenenbaum. He's a spokesman for Penn National. That's the company who will develop the proposed casino in Dayton. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Emily.
So can you tell me why having a casino in Dayton is a good thing?
Well, we think it's a good thing primarily for economic and job creation reasons. The proposed racetrack, what tends to be called a racino, which is basically a racetrack with slot machines, but not the table games you'd see in a casino, in Dayton would create 1,000 construction jobs while it was under construction, and then approximately 1,500 permanent jobs, including the direct jobs at the facility itself, and jobs created in companies that are going to be servicing the facility with goods and services. So we think that, and the fact that we will be investing $150 million in the Dayton area with this facility, really makes a strong argument for it.
Now, when I spoke to a spokesperson for Ohio Roundtable last week, they said that Penn National would not be able to deliver on the promise of those jobs. What's your response to that?
Well, it's interesting that they would say that, because I think, as some people know, we opened our Toledo casino just about a week ago, a little more than a week ago. That casino, way back in 2009 during the campaign, we indicated that we would hire 1,200 permanent employees at the Toledo Casino. The fact is, when it opened, it already had 1,300. So we've delivered basically on every promise we've made, including the size of the facilities, the investment, the number of jobs. I think it's rather silly to make a claim like that, particularly when you can look at Toledo and say they did exactly what they promised and more.
So what about the idea that gambling money takes money from other entertainment industries in the Dayton area?
Obviously, we will be competing as an entertainment venue. One of the things we think is that there's a great deal of pent-up demand for this kind of entertainment. And I don't know that the people who are going to be going to the Dayton facility are necessarily going to stop doing everything else they've been doing. We also think Dayton is a good market for this kind of entertainment, and we wouldn't be investing this kind of money if we didn't think the community would support it.
Now, one of the main arguments by Ohio Roundtable was that this wasn't a constitutional, gambling isn't constitutional in Ohio. What is the feeling of the company, Penn National?
I can tell you what we argued in court, we and the other casino developer and the racetrack owners actually asked to be included in that lawsuit as defendants. It was originally filed only against the state and the Racing Commission and the Lottery Commission. The VLTs that have been proposed and actually are in operation at Scioto Downs in Columbus are part of the Ohio Lottery, which is obviously constitutional because the lottery is in the Constitution, as are the four casinos. So we felt that the Ohio Roundtable's arguments were legally weak. I think the judge agreed with us.
What do you think about the potential appeal to the lawsuit? Is the company concerned about that?
You know, it's not something we can do anything about. The decision of the Franklin County judge was pretty definitive. There were 17 counts in that lawsuit, and he dismissed all 17. really, at this point, we're dependent on the state, because while we have an agreement with the governor's office that we will pay a $75 million relocation fee to move our track from Toledo to the Dayton area, the State Racing Commission still needs to formalize that in the form of a rule. We don't anticipate any delays in that, but the next steps really are up to the state.
I've been speaking to Bob Tenenbaum. He's a spokesman for Penn National. Thanks for being here today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at wyso.org, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks to all our guests. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.